That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Why has an editor been allowed to turn a decent journal into this? A disgusting tabloid, pandering to the passions of the base morons.
I don't want any more economists, sages, or oracles bombinating over our cables. I want a reporter.
Pandering to the passions of the base moron. Wow, is that us? That must be
perhaps,
us.
Perhaps.
Wow. You've heard that before.
Well, I was just saying it reminds me of when I was editing a writer at the Weekly, Seattle Weekly, when I was editor there writing a story, and the guy looked at me and just said, oh, editing for the slack jaws again, eh?
Well, Michael Kinsley had a term for what's the best kind of reporter. The kind of reporter who turns in his story and then goes out, leaves the building, and is hit by a bus because he didn't want to hear.
He didn't want to hear what happened to my story.
The blowback from the story.
This is the Week in Review, wherein we don't just look at the news, but we rake over the coals. Slack jawed reporters. All right. Joni Balter is news analyst for KUOW, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. She writes for Bloomberg Views, or is it singular?
I think it's singular.
Bloomberg View. Knut Berger writes the Mossback column at crosscut.com. He blogs at Seattle Magazine and at Facebook and at other interesting places. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Steve.
Good to see you.
And you.
Eli Sanders is coming in. He'll be here in a moment. He is works at The Stranger. He rides his bike a lot, so sometimes, you know, it takes a little longer, and we feel good. We feel good about that because he's saving the environment.
It's
at the
those
same
bike
time.
Jams.
He gets into those bike jams. Is that what happened? Were you on your bike?
I was on my bike. I got in a little jam. The chain.
Oh,
jumped the tracks on the back gear,
and then you pedaled, and so it got jammed in there.
Yeah, it took a little while to pull it out. Sorry.
You know who needs to fix that? Somebody who's making $15 an hour working at a bicycle store. Thank you for that segue.
Oh, segue.
Good to see you, Eli.
Good to see you.
So let's start with the minimum wage debate because it continues to be interesting to me. Anything new before we go into sort of the philosophical stuff? Anything new that happened this week that shocked or surprised you about the debate?
Well, it's not shocked nor surprised, but I think what's going on with the debate is that we are getting close to that month called April when we're supposed to find out what will happen, and everyone is positioning themselves for it. So, and I think Mayor Ed Murray is in quite a situation here because, as has been made very clear this week, is that the group that wants 15 now isn't kidding, and they have a fairly low threshold to climb to get the signatures. 21,000 signatures?
To get it on the ballot.
To get on the ballot. It's so relatively easy to do that. And so they've got a position is you do what we want or else, here we come. Now, it's hard to say what the voters, in November, would say if they knew that the mayor was working in a more careful way toward $15, which may end up being the situation here. But you're starting to hear every version of the minimum wage. It's tough on teenagers because some adults have come in and taken some of those jobs that some folks want it phased in. Even The Stranger, which you wouldn't have thought would come to this sort of phase it in, maybe exempt small businesses, how to distinguish between small and large businesses, and yada, yada, yada.
Well, it becomes a nuanced argument once you start taking into account the studies that have been done. Seattle Times did a great piece that Lynn Thompson did looking at how it had affected places that have raised the minimum wage. And so there are lots of questions.
Lots of questions, right.
Anything you've learned about it this week that intrigued you, Eli?
That there are lots of questions. and lots of different proposals. I think we had a piece in The Stranger looking at some of them. And lots of different shades of business, as Joni alluded to, from giant corporations that are operating in the city to small businesses and then shades within small businesses, from restaurants to the bike store that you imagined and that I wish I had derailed in front of. So it is very, very complicated. That's true. And 15 now is very, very simple and compelling. And there's the jam, as you said, and the behind closed doors working group is working on all the different nuances we haven't quite seen where they've gotten yet. And I agree, we're waiting for them. We're waiting for the council. We're also waiting for Ed Murray to come in and say where he stands, because I think once he leads on this, it will provide some clarity as to where people who want to follow him should stand and then where people who want to maybe oppose him at the ballot should go.
It is interesting. He was on the record. He talked to Marcy earlier this week. And reading the between the lines, parsing the language, it does seem like that he seems like, how many ways can I
seems
moderate
like might
this?
Be, could be.
wants true. To see a phase in and not an immediate $15 an hour.
Well, let's look at the history on raising the minimum wage. It's usually phased in as an increase, including in the great state of Washington, from Initiative 688, which was passed in 1998. It had two single-year increases, I think, of 80 cents, and then it was tied to inflation, so it phased in. Go to the great state of California. They're raising theirs to $16 by January 1st, 2016, but they're doing it in two gradations, you know. So that is the history of it. So it's not like Ed Murray's some wild and crazy guy that's saying, what about phasing in?
Well, you know, $15 now is a great campaign slogan. And but we're a city is a big, complicated ecosystem. I mean, society is. So it implementing it is complex. And I think it's good to have to study it, to consider the different things. You can't simply by fiat raise the minimum wage because for everybody, because you have labor contracts, you have nonprofit groups where the wages have already been built into grant funding. You know, you have all kinds of – you have people who make less than $15 an hour in terms of their hourly wage who can still make, you know, $75 or $100 an hour if they're a waiter or waitress at a fancy restaurant. So there are people that are paid on commission. How do you calculate what they make? Often salespeople, for example, advertising salespeople, they get a very low base pay, but they drive BMWs, you know, because they can make a lot of dough. So I think it is complicated. It is nuanced. And I think the real issue beyond how quickly you get to $15 an hour and who pays it first and who, you know, et cetera, is that the underlying issue is income inequality. It's a bigger issue, a more complicated issue that way. And there was also a study out this week, I can't cite the source, but that was reaffirming that Seattle is the second most gentrifying city in America. The gentrification issue, I think, is resurfacing as an issue, and $15 wage is part of that. But there are a lot of other issues, because let's remember, a lot of the small business owners, restaurant owners, nail shop owners, you know, are people who are the people who suffer most from regressive taxes, suffer most from an unfair, say, B&O tax. Yet we're going to increase what they pay, and they can least able to afford it.
They may or may not be making $15 an hour themselves.
That's right. So I think there's a way in which you don't want to raise all boats and in the course of doing that punch holes in the bottom of the boats.
And yet,
and if you can continue the sea metaphor, that would be very good.
I hear Captain Phillips. Yeah.
And yet, find me the captain of industry or small business who is saying they don't want $15 an hour. The question is how quickly to get there. And even the mayor, as you said, has said we will have $15 an hour before the end of his first term, I believe.
Well, that's a lot different than 15 now.
I know that's different than 15 now, but to even have this kind of unanimous agreement beneath the debate is huge. That's a shift.
Well, one of the stories that appeared this week in the Seattle Times had a study that's been done by these folks out of University of California at Berkeley. And I interviewed the same guy for my Bloomberg View piece. And what's interesting, so, you know, so this thing is, how do you ramp this up so fast? So some of this has been studied. So these folks down at Berkeley, they studied hundreds of pairs of adjacent counties and states that had, you know, the federal minimum and then adjacent county that had a higher, including, relevant to us, Eastern Washington and Idaho. And what they found was that it didn't really change employment. It really didn't have a big impact. But this same guy, Michael Reich, who's quoted in the study, also said that they could only sort of speak to up to $13. They couldn't go to $15, especially in one move. So that's important.
You had touched on this in what you were just saying, Knut, and there is this debate. I know we've touched on a little bit, but there is this debate among the left as well as among the people on the right saying this is just crazy for government to be doing this. There's people on the left who are saying this is a distraction from the actual conversation we should be having. Gentrification, guaranteed incomes, housing subsidies. We started on health care.
Statewide tax system, which I was glad that someone else was banging the drum on because I know people have gotten tired of me talking about it, but the state tax system is
never
broken and contributes to this problem.
So does the $15 an hour debate solidify that deeper argument, or politically, are we, $15 an hour, we've solved it, we've taken care of the problem, and then we'll just punt on it again?
I actually think the debate is good. I think the $15 an hour discussion is a catalyst for that broader discussion, precisely because it brings up these other issues. Mm-hmm. I think when you talk about gentrification on its own, it's very difficult. But when you look at implementing this $15 an hour wage, it forces you to look at the details. And I also think the idea of holding out the threat of an initiative is good strategically. I think that makes sense strategically. And that was announced. There was a big headline in the Seattle Times this week about that, but it was stated months ago that that was going to be the plan. Mm-hmm. You know,
restated after it sort of started going. And how serious are you? And it turns out they have these teams that are going to go out and get the signatures, which again, 21,000, not that hard.
But I agree with Joni on the fact that this is the kind of complicated process that Murray has staked his mayorship on being able to initiate and come out with a good result. This is his deal. He has set up this plan. So if this committee doesn't work, if this thing falls apart with all these pressures, so it's a complicated thing, and so I think it's a big test for him.
I agree.
And rightly so.
And you see a parallel in the chief selection process, which is another complicated, nuanced, really thorny problem that has all kinds of interest groups involved that's moving along, sometimes below the radar, sometimes above, and is going to require leadership from the mayor at a certain point. Otherwise, he'll end up holding the bag for everyone's failures.
Well, remember when we talked about he had a lot of committees? It's sort of like he's set up the April from heck, I think I'm allowed to say that, because the committees all sort of do their stuff and come back right around middle, beginning, end of April, and he is going to just be absolutely bombarded with, here's what your police chief kind of sort of should look like, here's what the minimum wage kind of sort of should look like, you know, and they've got that deadline of, what was the deadline for the...
For which? Which deadline do we speak of?
Folks, to get real serious. April 20 yeah. something. I don't know.
In April, yeah.
But anyway, this is going to be April, and lapsing into May is going to be,
right.
Oh my gosh.
Well, wasn't it T.S. Eliot that said April is the cruelest month? And when you campaign on first 100 days, I'm going to do this. First 100
yes,
days.
He filled it.
You set the bar there for yourself.
Pretty busy mayor.
I do agree with Knut that the debate that's going on in terms of $15 an hour is very useful in terms of raising these other issues, and also in terms of showing, we sort of discussed this last week, that, you know, as much as low-wage earners and small business owners can seem at odds in moments in this debate, and maybe are, their mutual enemy and far greater enemy is the B&O tax system and the state tax system, which needs reform. And so if you come out of this process with more people understanding something that is ultimately not very sexy but very consequential, which is the state tax system, that is good and maybe leads to reform of that ultimately.
It is interesting that, like you say, that he has set himself up for getting answers and having to move forward in the next few months, not police, this parks district, which we'll talk about in a minute, all these ideas. So I guess if you want action from a mayor, he's taken the step in the first few months. We'll take a break and come back on the Week in Review with Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter on KUOW. You're listening to the Week in Review. on KOW Seattle with Knut Berger, with Eli Sanders, with Joni Balter. We were talking about the efforts on the part of the debaters over the $15 an hour minimum wage and the question of what's happening with that debate. Just real quickly, did you folks notice that there was the citizen panel that had released its findings on and their ideas for the police accountability system? This is the Citizens Advisory Panel. So they came up with 30 recommendations that would deal with the Seattle Police Accountability System. So just while we've been debating this, they've been working.
Committees.
They are charged. There's still the monitor is also charged. And their recommendations, according to the Times, and when you read them, you'll see they sort of reflect the person who had the most complaints about what had happened with this. With the discipline problems that Harry Bailey and then Ed Murray acted on and then withdrew, and that was Ann Levinson. And then next month, Merrick Bob is supposed to be submitting his own proposal for how we have a
told you, April's
oversee.
Just going to be impossible.
Yeah. It'll be good. It'll be very good. Just on that question of income equality and how they address it, of course, the other aspect of that is healthcare. And they have to get a lot of people still signed up for healthcare.gov by the end of the month. And one of the things that happened this week because of that was the full court press that we've been seeing on the part of the government. So just a quick thought on this. So President Obama went on Funny or Die Between Two Ferns with comedian Zach Galifianakis. It's a parody of a cable access interview show. It's like this show, really. And here's some of what President Obama had to endure.
I have to know, what is it like to be the last black president?
Seriously? What's it like for this to be the last time you ever talk to a president?
It must kind of stink, though, that you can't run, three times,
No, actually, I think it's a good idea. If I ran a third time, it'd be sort of like doing a third Hangover movie. Didn't really work out very well, did it?
By the way, President Obama brings the slap down on that. He was there for a serious reason, though. He wanted to get in front of young people who are presumably watching the inner tubes and try to convince them to sign up for health care.
Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. That's the thing that doesn't work. Why would you get the guy that created the Zune to make your website?
Harsh.
Ouch.
Ouch. Was it a good idea for him to go on? He got 15 million views. Was it a good idea to go on that show?
100%. I thought that was the funniest. Now, I know people were ripping him and say he demeaned the presidency and, he barely got his message out. I thought he was toe-to-toe with the guy whose last name, please help.
Zach Galifianakis.
Him too. I thought he was fantastic. He gave him a little dig there on the
Hangover movie.
On the Hangover movie, which really didn't go very well. And then back after with the Zune. Wasn't that Mr. DelBene? Is that who he's referring to? I assume so. I just thought that interview was hilarious. And it had the added benefit of getting all these folks who are like, I'm not paying attention to the Affordable Care Act because, and they had this little exchange about who's invincible or invisible. That was pretty funny. But it wasn't invisible. It turned out that a lot of people saw it and even went to that really fun website to sign up.
The really fun healthcare.gov website to sign up, yeah.
He's caught between two demographic groups here, the older Americans who have been a little bit more on their game and signed up in greater numbers for healthcare reform through healthcare.gov, and younger Americans who they need more of in the pool in order to make it more viable financially and who have signed up in lesser numbers, but who it's thought tend to procrastinate or just not know what's going on unless Zach Galifianakis tells him.
or John Stewart, yeah.
Right. Right. That's the theory, anyway, that Obama was working on. And, it was very entertaining, and I thought very successful at getting his message out.
Boy, there were people pulling their hair out on the old Fox News channel. They were just pulling their hair out.
Well, that's why they're there,
to pull their hair out.
Pull their own hair out. And they, and I like how Bill O'Reilly is, positioned himself as the person who would most know what Lincoln would have done not done. Lincoln had a great sense of humor, by the way, and that's, documented. Richard Nixon was on Laugh-In. Bill Clinton was on Arsenio Hall.
But they weren't president yet.
What's that?
Was Nixon was
they were candidate. Yeah. They were presidential candidate, but he had been vice president. So I think that the use of No, but the use of popular culture to convey serious messages or to get a demographic group like young people, the reason Nixon went on Laugh-In was because he knew 18-year-olds
thought he was a dork
or whatever. And, yeah. You know, I, no, I mean, you know, he went on because he was trying to reach younger voters. And that's the same thing that Obama did. And I think it's a very smart move.
By the way, go ahead.
I was just going to say the fact is the mainstream media is not connecting with younger Americans and younger voters in the numbers that it would need to get that message across. So what is the president supposed to do?
By the way, is that us? Young people, email us. If you're 25 and under, Twitter us or tweet us.
That would be tweet. Yeah.
Just I like making everything a verb. But just as a side, I have come to be reading Time magazine. Stephen Brill wrote this long article about the team that Obama assembled. And we shouldn't say Obama because the team that was assembled after the failure of healthcare.gov. And though Zach Galifianakis made that joke about the Zune guy,
Yeah. They
really did bring in, they really did do a full court press and bring in the people they thought were the best and the brightest to turn this thing around. And they got a lot of cooperation from these high tech techno guys.
Well, here's the thing. I don't know that full on Obamacare works, but the website kind of does, you know? So that's, where's that big story?
Yeah. Well, hence, I recommend you read that because it was very interesting to read that and see how that had done. All right. Skip, you, Knute, you and Danny Westneat in the Seattle Times, and we kind of alluded to it last week, wondered whether we were getting another round of the Disneyfication of Seattle. And just a little history, there was an effort on the part of the Royer administration?
Charles Royer.
Yeah.
To bring in Disney Imagineers to try to revitalize the Seattle Center, and that didn't go over very well,
yeah.
Right?
Well, you know, and here, talk about history repeating itself. Seattle Center was kind of frowsy. It needed some updating. They needed to come up with some new ideas. The Sonics were thinking of leaving Seattle Center and building a basketball arena, guess where? In SoDo. They were going to build it right next to the Kingdom. So, I mean, there's a lot of parallels between now and where we were in the mid-80s. And, what brought this to mind was Danny Westneat wrote a column saying that some of the plans he was seeing, the gondola, some of the things that the Pike Place Market wants to do and the waterfront stuff seemed, he used to, what I call the D word and the B word. He said it was too much like Disney. They were kind of airbrushing the waterfront. And the B word was Bellevue, too much, too, you know, suburban, too sterile.
Drawings of glass-funded atriums that have the feel of Bellevue Square.
Yeah, right. Which, you know, in Seattle, that's like the worst thing you can say about anybody or anything, you know. So, you know, if they've got Danny Westneat out there throwing out these fighting words. So I wanted to, when I saw the Disney thing, I thought, well, you know, we've been here before. And So Disney was hired by the city to come up with a plan for Seattle Center. It was a contentious process. They did. They came up with three proposals. People hated them. And part of the thing they hated was they felt like no matter how much public input there was, Disney didn't listen. They just did what they wanted to do. They also said this makeover plan was going to cost $60 million. And when the final bill came in, it was $335 million.
I remember.
People, but the main thing in people is in Seattle basically said, look, you know, we know what we like about Seattle Center. Let's just make the changes that we want to make, you know. And it's one of these things where regardless of what you think about whether the James Corner design people are doing a good job on the waterfront or not, they're making mistakes in the PR war. You know, they're showing us pictures that look like San Diego. Every day is sunny. There are no homeless people on the street. There's no rain. They're suggesting things like floating pools or sea stacks, which, you know, you get on the Oregon coast or in Nia Bay. You don't get those in Puget Sound. It's like they still, after all the work that's gone into it, it just has this feeling that it's being designed by people who aren't listening or who just don't get us in some way. And I think there's that's a kind of I think concern about that is growing along with the complexity of what's proposed now.
And how we're going to pay for it.
So a bit of history here, and I did write some of those stories about the Disney stuff. At the time, this was the height of Lesser Seattle, so there was another, you don't like the word Bellevue, another word people didn't like was California.
Yeah.
And so the whole idea that these, you know, I don't want to call them snobby, but they had a little bit of that when they came north and started talking about turning this play. I mean, they had everything but the Matterhorn in that thing. They did not speak Seattle. They spoke California. They spoke of a Disney thing. And it was, I'm sure it was a disappointment for Charles Royer because he sort of got laughed out of the city on this idea because the city council was not interested. The price was, just alarming. And the idea that Seattle Center, which had its own unique thing, didn't want too much from Disney. Maybe a few good ideas, but nothing that said Disney, that seemed Disney.
If you want to see gritty Seattle waterfront, go step under the viaduct and look up. That's the other story that we had this week was the cracks growing and spreading. And so the somewhere between the decaying, collapsing, only semi-functional viaduct and this Disneyfied vision of what the waterfront could be is hopefully a happy medium that works, doesn't fall apart, and is Seattle.
Well, to all of you, what would make sense right now? I mean, we've had enough time to look at the plans and see what works. What would you like to see? So our email, weekinreview@kuow.org, what would you like to see down there that is missing? And I want to start by asking the question of what you think about the connection to the market and the Pike Place Market's own plans, which some, there's a little bit of a feel of Bellevue Square in some of what they're proposing at this point. So what do you think about that connection?
Well, I kind of disagree with Danny about that Bellevue thing. I for the Pike Place Market, that was his characterization of it. I think that the idea of developing that section at the market, I think, is great. One of the things I like about
it. This is where there's a parking lot now, and then it
leads. Right, there was
down
a market building there. It burned. It's a parking lot. They would change that into housing. They would expand the stall areas and create a great view section that would look out. And this is something people have said, we'll keep part of the viaduct so we can go up there and get a beautiful view. Well, you can kind of get that from what the market is proposing. And then it would connect to this passage that wends its way down to the waterfront.
And this is the corner.
The corner proposal. So it connects into that. And that proposal has been revised and slimmed down a little bit from the thing. Connecting to the waterfront and those kinds of things are good. It also has, people have to think about the market not as, just a historic structure. It's a neighborhood, and the development that they do there incorporates into it social services for low-income downtown residents. There are market rate people, people that buy those condos and whatnot, but they do create new housing opportunities for people who aren't wealthy. And I think that's something they add to that waterfront redevelopment. And I'd like to see more of that. I think some of that public property that they're talking about turning into sort of lots of open space, I think they should consider some kind of low-rise, multi-income development down there. I think the concern that I have is seeing them create a huge open space that then has to, quote, be activated, where you have to spend a fortune bringing in, mimes and all kinds of, things to keep the space going. Seattle Center is a classic example of how difficult that is to accomplish.
Well, here's the deal. When you have folks come in with these big, grand ideas, very expensive, you'll always find, and this actually did happen with Seattle Center, that a couple of the ideas remain because they're maybe the better ideas or they're the ideas that fit. So if I remember this correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the Disney Imagineers, when they came in, they looked at Memorial Stadium and they thought this should be some kind of an open space. It could still be functional in different ways, so they're still talking about that same idea today. It's one of the few that stayed. Didn't they have like an ice skating rink or something?
They did.
Yeah. But so that one didn't stay at the moment. But
which I would support.
Which I would support. But so from this whole thing of the waterfront, you'll find that the, I'm guessing, you'll find that the ideas that really like beautifully connect the market with the waterfront, or, you know, just a bunch of the other sort of cross walkways, whatever people like the most will be. And that is, isn't that what you're asking the designer
yes.
to come up with? Anyway, give us 10 ideas. We'll take 3 or 4, right?
I like the idea of low-income housing somewhere in the mix down there, because ultimately we'll be losing the People's View, the viaduct, the way the working class could get that picture of Elliott Bay and the mountains on their way to work. And so to bring people down there on a more permanent basis would be a very beautiful use of the space.
I just here's an email that sort of this is raises the question as I have. I wish I didn't think that the proposed Elliott Bay Water Park is another mega project designed by Business for Business to capitalize on the restructure of the waterfront. Odd that this has come about after the citizens of Seattle last year too quickly agreed to a rebuilding of the seawall. The new separate park nonprofit putting this proposal together really needs to be scrutinized before this goes any further.
Well, do you remember during the debate over the tunnel, folks said that it would just be for the high rises to get, you know, to clear the view here.
Yeah.
And so that debate rages on, you know.
Is in the mix a discussion still of whether it will be more than open space? That's why I'm a little vague on it. When we see coroners' proposals, it seems like we're mostly
is being looked at as public space. And the rationale, which is not unreasonable at all, is that this is going to be public open space. Let's do something for the public with it, you know. And I think you have to define that in terms that are both realistic in terms of the actual people who are going to show up down there. And public benefits could address some of the income inequality issues we've just been discussing, instead of having it just be a 3-month-a-year place for cruise ship folks and wealthy people who can afford to live adjacent to it.
I mean, I love Myrtle Edwards Park. It's a really neat park. But sometimes I look at that design, it seems like that's what we're going to get as an extension of that to the south.
Certainly a lot of the drawings suggest that kind of thing. The thing I would point out, and this is not an anti-outsider. This isn't like, oh, James Corner, they're from New York. You know, that's a bad thing. People love the High Line, which they contributed to in New York. And I think the thing is that, but there are other examples in Seattle by both local and outside people of great design. I think the Sculpture Park is a success.
And was designed by people from New York.
Yes, exactly. In terms of local stuff, we have very innovative use of space. The Burke-Gilman Trail was pioneering in its creation of a railroad right-of-way to a bike and pedestrian lane. It was way ahead of its time. Gasworks Park is another example.
Olmsteads, but I was
Gasworks was.
No, I wasn't talking about that. I was saying.
Okay.
And then add the Olmsteads in there.
Well,
that's true. Yeah, okay. The ultimate New Yorkers.
There you go.
And if you look at Myrtle Edwards Park, it is active without a lot of bells and whistles drawing people down there. It's just biking paths and walking paths and beautiful views and benches to sit on, and people use it, and not just wealthy people who live down on the waterfront. And same with the Sculpture Park.
Is that enough? Is that enough for you? Would that be enough if that's what the, if that's what was created out of that waterfront area?
I like Knut's idea of more housing and affordable housing down there, but I also would err on that side of providing open space, providing some incentive and some usability to the space, but then to let people make what they will of the space, to make it a people's waterfront.
Well, sort of cost benefit, and that sounds wonky, and I apologize, but it's sort of like, so how much are you going to ask us to pay for this? And then how active can it be without paying the highest amount you can think of?
Yeah, the mimes would get $15 an hour hired by the city. Just to tie this together a little bit, as we had talked about doing, I had a conversation with Jim Deers about the mayor's upcoming neighborhood summit.
Was that in April?
Yeah.
It is.
But one of the things Jim Deers said was that what he would like to see a return to, Jim Deers, the former head of the Department of Neighborhoods in Seattle for a long time, and the guy who helped to get it going starting in 1988, was that we need a return to bottom-up planning, so citizens being in charge of designing the city that they live in, and participatory democracy. Is that what's happening with this, or with the mayor's proposal for a park taxing district? Or are we still getting a feeling of top-down? How do you look at those two, three things?
Well, it's very interesting because, first of all, with the park taxing district, you're essentially you're creating a new entity, putting it under the sort of supervision of the city council that would have the ability to raise property taxes for park maintenance citywide. And I think there's a sense that everybody loves parks. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that's going to provoke a lot of opposition based on the idea and the sort of reality of it. So
just by double your taxes.
On the other hand, there's some opponents who are basically this is the way I was articulating it at a discussion the other night, who basically view it as another Port of Seattle, an independent agency that's going to be making a lot of decisions. And do you really want another kind of Port of Seattle entity running our park system? So I think there's an issue about taxation and the cost. I think it was $14 a month is what the impact would be on that. That's a lot of money for some people. We have neighborhoods in Seattle that oppose the bag tax by 90%. 90% of the vote against the bag tax. There are people that are very sensitive to these kinds of issues.
$14 a month on property owners.
On property owners.
So which goes to renters. It goes to renters eventually.
Yes, but some of the people who are most price sensitive or tax sensitive would not be forced to pay this. I guess it would be passed on as your argument, but the tax is actually going on property owners. And in terms of bottom-up leadership, the city has voted over and over and over again to fund parks, so there has been kind of a grassroots statement over time that we support this. And there's actually an argument to be made that it's fatiguing to just keep going back to the ballot and having people saying yes. The people have said in aggregate over time, just make this work.
I think the danger of the waterfront plan is that you have to make sure that people buy into that plan so that you don't create opposition through, to say, the taxing district by having it become an example of the birthaization of the waterfront in terms of cost. And I think also because of the new district system that's coming up in 2015, I think the kind of neighborhood concerns are going to be raised at this summit that have to do with, will the city, the central city, listen to what we want?
I had one kind of facetious thought here, and that was, could Bertha do any work while she's kind of sitting around to fix to fix the waterfront? Anything Bertha could do, I mean, maybe she's not going to...
Apparently she's doing a little work on the viaduct, so on that one. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk about the cracks in the viaduct, some other issues. Luke Burbank will join us as well. This is the Week in Review on KUOW. We are reviewing the week in review for a review of the week.
Keep going.
Are you reviewing anything? Khalid Burju writes the Mossback column at Crosscut. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. And Joni Balter, who's host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. And Eli had mentioned a little earlier about stories about cracks widening in the viaduct. Marcy Silman talked with Ed Murray earlier this week about how he feels about driving across the Alaska Way Viaduct.
I have been on the viaduct since I've been aware of those cracks.
And you don't clutch the handle, the door handle?
I have a rosary. No.
Do you worry about driving across the viaduct?
I hold my breath when I'm driving on the upper one and the lower one for different reasons in some ways. No, I do think that, and Eli's a little fixated on the viaduct cracks in a funny way, but I mean, it's every day you read the paper and it's sinking more and it's lower, it's deeper, it's a wider crack. I mean, we're running out of time here to get cracking.
Should we? That's terrible. I remember when Christine Gregoire talked about shutting it down. Other people talked about shutting it down if it was dangerous. We had that earthquake go off California's coast this week, and I'm sure there were people who thought, the viaduct again. I mean, are you nervous about it?
Yeah, and I don't think it's inappropriate fixation. I mean, the politicians in the state have been warning about this forever. There's a video that you can find out there of the, I think it's a state DOT simulation of what would happen if the viaduct fell in an earthquake, and it's the most apocalyptic scene you can imagine on the waterfront. It will result in a lot of death and damage if people are on the viaduct when there's an earthquake and it crumbles, and it's not really a question of if it will, if the earthquake is strong enough. So there's concern, and when you bring up Gregoire, she was planning to have it down, if I'm remembering it right, by 2012.
At one point, yeah.
So here we are in 2014.
Should they shut it down? I mean, that's the panic, right?
The whole rationale of digging the deep bore tunnel was based on the idea that WashDOT said they could bolster the viaduct and keep it operating while they dug the alternative.
Right, that's
and
right.
The reason was they didn't want to destroy all those businesses on the waterfront. It's a huge chunk of our tourism industry, and there are other industries down there as well. And it's so the idea was we could keep it going. And the people who were for the retrofit are arguing, well, look, Bertha's stalled. We should have done the retrofit. And the fact that there are more cracks is, you know, that could have been fixed much cheaper and faster if we had done that. So everybody's second guessing and rethinking. I mean, it's scary when you read like the Seattle Times article and basically say, well, you know, these cracks are showing up. They're some of the biggest ones are only about a 16th of an inch, but they're in a section that, you know, we haven't had problems with before, but it's not due to Bertha. But we're going to spray, you know, squeeze some epoxy in there, you know, and suddenly it's like, okay, they're gluing it together. I mean, it just, you know, it doesn't give you a lot of confidence. But, you know, I mean, if the big one hits, the big one hits, and a lot of stuff in Seattle is going to go down. So I don't think that's the standard, but the standard is can they keep it within some sort of safe zone? And to what degree will the Bertha repair process and other things make that more difficult or easy? And how long will it stretch the schedule? They say they can do everything roughly on the original schedule. I don't believe it.
Another thing that's going on here is there are people, and I would count myself among them, who think you could take the viaduct down now and essentially have the surface transit option resurrected and implemented and tested while they dig the tunnel, while they move forward toward redesigning the waterfront, and see if it's such an impossible thing to have downtown function without the viaduct there. It would be a demonstration. A lot of people think that this is, excuse me, a viable alternative.
About that time, Bertha will start working, of course. But cheaper, faster, to go back to something Skip said, isn't that the definition of the kingdom? Isn't that what we did?
Cheaper.
Got to be careful, cheaper, faster.
By the way, they in digging under the viaduct, they're now thinking about artifacts, and what they're finding there is all that construction.
Well, and I want to clarify something about the archaeology down there, because I've written about this. But WashDOT told us yesterday that they were going to do testing. They're basically – they now know – Seattle Tunnel Partners has given them a proposal for this pit that they want to dig, which will give them access to Bertha. So it's 120 feet wide. It's 120 feet deep. I mean, and it's going to be round. When they did the law requires that they take into consideration the potential impact of the project on cultural resources. And cultural resources include archaeological materials that might be found in those first 20, 30, 40 feet before you get down to the pre-human occupation level, which is where Bertha is now. And what they're going to do is do about 60 test drills. And that's just to so they're going to take core samples, and that is to determine whether or not there's anything. It isn't to find artifacts. It's basically to educate them about what's there, because they didn't test that area extensively because no one expected they were going to have to dig a big pit there.
Huh.
One of the big concerns, and the tribes have the concern, and it's in the reports that they did, is that when you get in the tide areas and the shoreline areas, which is where this would be in the pre-settlement period, well, and even in the post-settlement period, the chance that you might run into things like Indian, Native American bones, fishing weirs. There's all kinds of stuff that could be down there. So the more they know before they start digging that hole, the better. So they're trying to get a handle on that. They're not specifically looking for, you know, a specific thing.
They're just being careful.
They're being careful.
Luke Burbank joins us. Luke is the host of LiveWire on KUOW, as you heard a little earlier. He's got an interesting show. Tonight at 8 on KUOW, also hosts the podcast TBTL, among his various duties. Also is a contestant on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Luke, we were concerned about your trips to Portland to host LiveWire.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a cat down there that has gotten a lot of trouble for attacking babies and maybe other dogs. Are you worried about what happens in Portland?
Well, I mean, obviously, cats are a concern anytime you visit Portland. I want to mention, though, on the question of the viaduct, if we have Imagineers poking around down there, can we have them build some kind of giant bouncy castle under the viaduct? If it collapses, you get a fun ride, at least, down to the bouncy castle.
That's good. Have you seen the crystal elevator that they want to drop down from the Four Seasons Hotel down to the base? That could be a nice kind of...
That sounds Wonka-esque.
The bubble-later that they had at the
I want to also mention, Steve, if you guys really want to connect with youth culture, there's nothing like bringing up the misdeeds of the Charles Royer to just really, really rope in the under-25 demo.
Well, in my interview with Jim Deers, I want you to say we talked about all the neighborhood activists of the 80s, and the producer was listening to it, said, you know, I don't care about any of this stuff. But, Luke, we have to know our history.
Yeah, right. Well, I'll tell you about the cats in Portland. Okay, so there was this news story this week, right, where the family got trapped in a room because their cat was just going wild. I have, no joke, a long-running fear of cats. I think it dates back to when I was a kid and I was beating my neighbor's cat.
Beating your neighbor's cat?
Feeding.
Oh,
with
feeding.
An
That's a little better. Yes. That's a little better.
Yeah, no. Although afterwards, I felt maybe like beating her because this cat kind of attacked me, scratched up my arms. And it, you know how you have those things that happen when you're young can very much affect how you move through your adult life. And I've always been a little nervous about cats. And the reason is because if you think about a dog, if a dog were the size of, a cow, it would just be generally a docile animal. It would still probably like you. It probably wouldn't try to kill you. The only reason your cat is not trying to kill you is because it's not big enough. Like, think about what a large cat is. It's a lion. This is why we should fear cats, because they're just lying in wait, and they're just held back by their size at this point.
And the fact that you provide them with kitty litter as well.
Not the litter so much as the food. I think that they're kind of like, they'll tolerate you because you're giving them food. But I mean, I don't think we should turn our backs on the cats. Just
right.
Generally, I think what happened in Portland this week is a really good reminder of that.
Especially if they're 22 pounds. That's getting on the way toward lion, right?
Yeah.
That was not a small cat. That was not a small cat. I did have a question about what's on LiveWire tonight. Why is that man saying words randomly in the promo cut?
Well, I'm glad the promo worked in that you're deeply confused and have no idea what's on the show tonight. So, way to go, LiveWire staff. That's a guy named Wesley States. You probably interviewed him, Steve.
Oh, I have, yes.
John Wesley Harding. And he wrote this book about the phenomenon of kindy bands, right? These are the bands that make music for kids, but they're kind of indie, so they're parents, like people my age who are still clinging desperately to their youthfulness. They can feel okay about liking the music because it's not Rafi.
It's not Rafi. What's wrong with Rafi, man?
Well, the people of my age with kids who are, you know, waiting for Costco to introduce Kirkland brand skinny jeans, they're not ready to give up on their sort of youth, and so they want their kids to listen to bands that are making kids music, but in a kind of cool way that makes them feel okay about themselves. And this guy Wesley States, he wrote this book about just such a band, and what he's listing in the promo are a bunch of actual kindy band names.
Well,
like
I hope
Spit Rags.
I hope he got Casper Tantrums. Baby Pants in there.
I don't know if he mentioned the beloved local act Casper Baby Pants, but I do like those guys, Chris Ballou and Fred Northrup and the rest of them.
Kindy bands and skinny jeans at Costco. Very good, Luke. You give me lots to think about today. And that's your job.
Yeah, well, I'm here to really bring in a youthful injection.
Yes, that's right.
To the show. By the way, I'm almost 40, so you got to get some more youthful injectors.
I think, what are you, like 30? What the hell are you? Eli,
I'm 37. I'm going to be 38 very soon.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, if I'm the youth component of the show, we really need to reimagine this whole.
No,
we need some
that's
Imagineers
Eli.
On the show.
Eli's the youth component.
Well, the Pulitzer ages you by 15 years. Everybody knows that.
Yeah, it did give him.
It
gravitas.
Has not in his case. He's just a very good example.
Just gave him gravitas. All right.
My ears started drooping. I got jowls immediately.
Luke, have a good week.
And thank you very much.
Thank
and we'll see you guys next week if the viaduct doesn't collapse.
Yeah, that's right. And Knut, have a good week.
Thank you.
And
Steve.
Weekend. You guys too. Eli, Joni.
Take care.
Eli's going to be taking care of the youth.
The youth.
He'll be talking
He's
to the
tending
youth.
To them.
Jason Bagano produces the show. Well, another person taking care of the youth in one way or another, his own in this case. And Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, hi. I have a kind of a particular emergency here. My cat attacked our 7-month-old child, and I kicked the button, the cat in the rear, and it has went off over the edge, and we aren't safe around the cat. It's a very large Himalayan.